Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Stem cells from cloned human embryos, Harvard University announced today that it has received the necessary clearance to begin using what is known as somatic cell nuclear transfer or therapeutic cloning to create disease-specific stem cell lines. Now, the university says it has completed a 2-year review process involving Columbia University and 8 institutional review boards, as well as other stem cell oversight groups, and that it, Harvard, will soon begin experiments using cloned embryos and extracted stem cells to treat certain diseases. This news is all breaking today at midday, and Here Now's Rachel Gottbaum has been listening online to the phone press conference that Harvard is holding, and she joins us now. And Rachel, this announcement of what Harvard plans to begin doing sounds like what the South Korean scientist Dr. Hwang Woo-suk said that he did, but that later turned out to be a fraudulent claim.
That's right. Hwang said that he had created stem cells from cloned embryos, and in fact, that was found to be not true.
So what is the importance of today's announcement from Harvard?
What's important here is that this is the first non-commercial effort to take stem cells, create stem cells from cloned embryos. And this involves Harvard University and Columbia University.
Yeah, and remind us of what therapeutic cloning is.
What therapeutic cloning is, it's to create disease-specific stem cells. So you take a skin cell, an adult skin cell, for example, any adult cell from a person, and you put it inside an egg where the DNA has been removed. That egg gets reprogrammed. Then you derive stem cells from that egg.
And those eggs have the disease specific to the original stem cell that you, or the original skin, let's say, that you used.
That's right.
And so what would be the benefit of this?
This way, researchers can study stem cells that have diseases.
Right. And they can possibly help cure and treat these largely inherited diseases, diseases like diabetes. What are some of the plans for these stem cells?
Well, Doug Melton at Harvard will be looking at diabetes. His two kids have diabetes. One researcher he works with will eventually be looking at Lou Gehrig's disease. At Children's Hospital in Boston, they'll be looking at blood diseases.
And where this gets tricky, we understand, is first of all the eggs. These will come, we understand, from infertility clinics. But also, what is the existing federal legislation regarding therapeutic cloning?
Well, there's a bill out now that would ban human cloning, that's full cloning, but would allow therapeutic cloning, such the cloning that we're discussing now. However, it would not be federally funded. These researchers are using entirely private funds to do this work.
Right. And so is there any legislation now that covers them? Because Harvard is saying that they've completed a process and a cell oversight group process, but is there any legislation right now in effect that would ban this kind of work?
There is also another bill that has come out that has not been passed that would ban this work, yes.
Okay, understand. Back to the egg issue, just very briefly, Rachel, we just were hearing a report this morning, in fact, on NPR, that there is concern that women might not know that their eggs in infertility clinics might be going towards this work.
Well, in fact, what they would do would be asking women, and they would be signing a form saying that they would like to donate their eggs, and many women have already done this.
Okay. Here now is Rachel Gottbaum on today's breaking announcement from Harvard University that its researchers will begin doing experiments using cloned embryos and extracted stem cells to study and perhaps lead to the cure and treatment of certain inherited diseases. Rachel, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, we'll follow that story, but we want to spend a few minutes today on a new trend in video games. These are games produced to disturb and hopefully educate players. They're free. They're downloaded off the internet. They're games like Darfur is Dying, which puts the players in the role of helpless Sudanese refugees, or Super Columbine Massacre RPG. Now, in this game, players take the part of the two students who killed 13 people in their Colorado high school in 1999. You're listening to the sounds of the game. It features graphic crime scene photos, Some parents of children who were killed that day say the game does not educate, it exploits. We'll talk to the creator in a minute, but first, an unlikely player. Richard Castaldo was shot and paralyzed during the Columbine shootings. He joins us now. And Richard, we understand you've played this game. Why? Why did you decide to play it?
Well, I was just kind of curious about it. I mean, parts of it are kind of difficult to, you know, play, and then there's some montage scenes that are kind of pretty graphic and, you know, hard to watch.
Some would be astonished that you were able to play it, given that you were shot that day. As we said, you're paralyzed now from the chest down. But how do you feel about it being out there? I mean, as we said, some of the parents of your friends who died have been outraged at this. How do you feel about the game existing?
Well, I can definitely see why some people would be outraged, but I think at least in part it was seemed like it tried to shed some light onto why it happened and kind of the things leading up to it.
Yeah, it tries to sort of depict the two and what was going on in their lives, the two shooters that day. You've also said that you appreciate the fact, to some degree, that something like this was made.
Yeah, well, I just meant, like, I think it could maybe help people learn more about it that play video games rather than, like, you know, like reading a book.
So it's sort of an education aspect to it.
Yeah, and learn how horrible it was. I mean, I think it's pretty graphic in parts.
Yeah.
I mean, it takes those real shots and kind of de-glamorizes it at the same time.
You've also said that you've heard of some kids trying to, you know, make folk heroes out of the killers, and that perhaps this will change that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it seems like a lot of kids, I mean, I found stuff online that were, like, you know, kind of trying to, almost like worshiping them or something. And I think if you play this game, you'll kind of realize, oh, you know, maybe this isn't so cool.
Richard Castaldo, a former student at Columbine High, weighing in on the video game Super Columbine Massacre RPG. Richard, thanks so much.
Yeah.
Well, now we want to turn to someone who knows this game well. He created it. Danny Ladoni was a sophomore in another Colorado high school when the shootings took place at Columbine. He joins us on the line from Alamosa, Colorado. Danny, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Danny, so far your game has been downloaded over 40,000 times. What are you trying to achieve with this game?
Well, I think players can take away a number of things. It may make them feel uncomfortable, and actually I'm quite fine with that, because on some level something like this should make you feel uncomfortable, and there's a reason for that. But on another level, I feel like the game is also a source of education for people who may not know very much about the shooting or who are interested in the subject matter and, you know, through an unconventional medium can learn more about it.
You know that some of the parents have said that, for instance, Brian Rohrbaugh, whose son Daniel was one of those killed, told the Associated Press that your game disgusts me, he says. You trivialize the actions of two murderers and the lives of the innocent.
I'm curious as to whether or not, you know, these family members or these people feel that, say, a film on this subject trivializes this. And I don't think so, because we as a society have not yet viewed video games with the same level of academic or artistic credibility that, for example, a film would have.
In addition to the game itself, there's an online forum where people talk about the game and the massacre. Some pretty disturbing messages. For example, one person wrote, "More people need to die at school for being bullies and making fun of other people. This will teach them."
Well, certainly the forum takes all kinds, and I weigh in when I get a chance to. There are certainly a vast number of people on the forum that I don't particularly agree with.
Would you endorse school violence?
I don't endorse violence of any kind. The analogy that I use is that one of my favorite films is Dr. Strangelove. This film depicts, you know, the advent of nuclear war, arguably one of the most, you know, horrific things ever to happen to humanity. Yet it's a movie, and a quite funny one. And so the question is, when Stanley Kubrick made this film, was he glorifying or advocating nuclear war? Well, the answer, I feel, is no. And so what's interesting to me is that this subject is one that so many people are interested in. You know, some of my critics have said, this game is popular but shouldn't be. And I don't think it is up to me to determine how popular this game should be. I think the fact that so many people from around the world are interested in this, that they're finding this and they're downloading this, and that really says something about where our society is at in terms of having an interest in this subject.
Do you think it says that people are concerned about violence in school and want to learn more about it, or do you think it says that there's a perverse sort of glee in seeing macabre images.
There is some degree of morbidity in the interests of some, but there are others who just genuinely feel like their view of Columbine hasn't really been expressed. The question I get asked often is, do you identify with the killers? And that's a tricky one, because some people are actually asking, do you feel they did the right thing? I don't feel like they did the right thing. But, you know, being a high school student who was pushed around, marginalized, sure, I identify with some of what the boys went through. Kids in that position look to Eric and Dylan as, you know, for better or for worse, as heroes, or at least examples of kids who, you know, just had enough and they snapped. Eric and Dylan were both phenomenally talented young men, and if, as I did, they ended up pursuing their interests, for example, in video game design or in creative writing, instead of, you know, taking this out in such a malevolent fashion, not only would they be alive, but of course so would their victims.
Danny Ladone, creator of the game Super Columbine Massacre RPG. Speaking to us from Colorado, Danny, thanks.
Absolutely.
Well, joining us now is Ian Bogost. He's assistant professor at the Georgia Institute of Technology and founding partner at Persuasive Games. They make games for change. He joins us on the line from Atlanta. Thank you, Ian.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you've written about the game Super Columbine Massacre RPG. What do you think about the fact that to play it, you have to step into the shoes of the killers?
Yeah, well, it certainly gives you a sense of what it's like to be in the experience itself, right, in the first person. And it's not a happy perspective. It's not comfortable. You don't play this game and feel, oh, I'm really glad to be enacting this. You feel very conflicted and extremely uncomfortable. And that's a perspective, I think, that's worthwhile. It's valuable. The notion that a video game about Columbine, no matter its content, no matter how it presents the events, would automatically be offensive and couldn't possibly be productive is an interesting problem, an interesting cultural problem that we should really look at more closely. I think what's going on is that video games are still struggling to be seen as a medium and not just a distraction, not just a kind of leisure time activity that you use to waste time. And, you know, interestingly, this happened before in every other medium, you know, and you can just look back to graphic novels and comics, for example, and think of a work like Mouse by Art Spiegelman, which was this graphic novel about the Holocaust. And you see some of the same kinds of issues coming up as we try to make sense of a medium like the video game. So I think it's unfortunate that so many folks, when they look at this game, they're not looking at the game itself. They're just responding to the concept that there's a video game about Columbine.
That's Ian Bogost. He's assistant professor at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Ian, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell you what, we're going to come back with Ian. He also founded a company called Persuasive Games. He creates what he calls video games with an agenda, so-called games for change. Now, you might find the Super Columbine Massacre disgusting because the players are the killers. And again, we're listening to the soundtrack of that game. But what about Darfur is Dying? The players in that game are the victims. Or games that encourage kids to be aid workers. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. He's founding partner of Persuasive Games. Ian, there's an emerging movement of so-called games for change, and part of that is a new video game called Darfur is Dying. What is that about?
Yeah, Darfur is Dying was a sort of a contest sponsored by MTVU, and the creator of that game is actually a student from the University of Southern California. Essentially, what this game is about is the ongoing crisis in the Darfur region of the Sudan, and it tries to give the player another kind of embodied perspective on that crisis. You play as the residents of a village that's been destroyed. You have to kind of recreate that, and one of the tasks that you have to take part in this game is to go out and fetch water. And you know, the Janjaweed militia in Darfur often try to kind of capture young people and rape and murder them as a result of this necessary step of finding water to bring back to the village. So, you know, again, it's this idea of representing the situation and kind of putting the player in that situation in the first person.
By the way, what options does the game give the person going out to try to collect wood or whatever while the Janjaweed are approaching? Because aid workers are saying there's, you know, really no solution. That, you know, women are raped and people are kidnapped. What happens?
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And in the game, the player is actually very powerless. You are running. You're on your own. There are these militia members in trucks, and you have to kind of hide behind rocks and things to avoid them. You can't pull out some kind of weapon and fire it at them. This is not the situation as it exists for these villagers.
That's Ian Bogost, who makes and teaches about video games with an agenda. We'll get back to Ian in a minute, but we want to quickly touch base with Joey Cheek. He's the U.S. Olympic speed skater who helped promote the launch of the Darfur is Dying game, and he donated his prize money from his two Olympic medal wins to help refugee children from Darfur living in neighboring Chad. Joey, thanks so much for giving us a couple minutes.
Oh, thank you, guys.
Hey, it sounds from the description of the game as if playing it may not be a lot of fun, you know, a feeling of helplessness, and yet 400,000 people have done this. You've played the game. What do you think is its appeal?
Well, I think the main appeal for me was that it's different. I mean, this is, you know, I was playing this game, and, you know, it's not entirely like being there, of course. It's not the same feeling, but it's sort of a similar feeling. You know, you're in this environment that's very foreign to you, and it's pretty well represented what it must be like to be in Darfur and to be in a village having to hide and escape and try to survive from day to day.
You had been interested in Darfur prior to playing the game, but have you seen this game, you know, interest other young people in getting involved and doing something?
Yeah, I have. Actually, I was just on the Hill a day or two ago at a press conference with a few congressmen. They were talking about the game, and it's being promoted by MTVU, which, you know, is a great vehicle with a lot of college kids. And I got to meet the designers, and they were talking about how, you know, their cousins and nephews had been playing the game in school. Their teachers had told them about it. So I think there's real penetration. It's really starting to reach people.
Joey Cheek, U.S. Olympic gold and silver medalist in speed skating and an advocate for peace in Darfur, and someone who's played the Darfur is Dying video game. Joey, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Darfur is Dying is one of the new games that deals with humanitarian crises. Another is called Food Force. It was released by the World Food Program. Let's listen to a few seconds of that.
Okay, quiet, everybody. Can I have your attention, please? I'm your officer in charge for this World Food Program mission. Our job is to do an aerial assessment to get an accurate picture of the food crisis so we can understand how many hungry people are in real danger.
That's a video game from the UN. We want to bring Ian Bogost back in. He founded a company that makes these so-called games for change. And Ian, the UN never thought theirs was going to be popular, but it's become a surprise smash hit.
A couple million people have downloaded the Food Force game. And as you described, the UN created this game to try to give a sense of what it means to provide food in these third world regions. And if anything, I think what this game does that's important is it gives the player a sense, hey, you know, being a humanitarian is a career. It's a possibility for me. It's something I could do in addition to being a doctor or a lawyer or a policeman. And I think that was the goal of the UN, was to try to show and kind of humanize the process of humanitarianism, if you will.
But, you know, Ian, for every one of those games, there is, for instance, a Border Patrol. This is one we've looked at where the object is to shoot immigrants as they cross the border from Mexico to the U.S. It seems as if you can't seem to filter out the bad ones from the good ones.
Oh, well, I mean, you know, it's a medium, and people make things and they release them into the world, and, you know, we can't control that in any medium. But I think what's important to note about these games and about video games as a medium is that, you know, they're not just about power fantasies, or they need not just be about power fantasies. They're a representational form, and we can make them about a whole range of different subjects, from those that we might find offensive or challenging to those that are just distracting and we just use to kind of entertain ourselves or waste some time. But the commercial industry isn't necessarily exploring all those possibilities, so you have these kind of independents and experimental folks who are doing this on their own, and it's only gaining legitimacy slowly through that kind of grassroots up.
Do you think there's ever anything that's going to be off the table? You would think, with Columbine being done, the answer might be no, but I'm wondering, you know, 9/11?
Sure, it's a great question. Probably no commercial game developer, at least among the very large developers, are going to touch this. But, you know, there was a game that a group of students made called 9/11 Survivor, which was about the experience of being stuck in the World Trade Tower after the attacks on that day. There was a game that a commercial developer in Scotland made about the assassination of JFK. I think that in general, commercial developers, they don't want to touch this. They don't like to take risks of this kind. But interestingly, that's not how Hollywood works, right? We do see filmmakers who are willing to take on difficult topics, and often with great success. I mean, just think back to Brokeback Mountain last year, right, mm-hmm. which is a controversial topic that really hit the mainstream in Hollywood. So I'm hopeful that these attitudes in the commercial game industry will change over time, but it's actually quite a bit of work to move the needle.
Ian Bogost, assistant professor at the Georgia Institute of Technology, talking about the free downloadable world of video games for change. Ian, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And this quick note, let's look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, the new Third Way, an online split ticket, presidential ticket. It's called United 8. We'll talk to Angus King, a former Maine governor, one of the people behind the move to get a Republican and a Democrat to run together on a presidential ticket in 08. Stay with us. Much more coming ahead Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, the Museum of Science.
In terror cell, were escorted into a courtroom 40 minutes north of Toronto for bail hearings. When brought before the judge, most of the dozen men complained about their detention conditions, saying they hadn't been allowed to pray together or see their families. In all, 17 people have been accused of plotting attacks in Canada, the 12 in court today and 5 minors who will have separate proceedings. Earlier today, family members of the suspects pushed through security lines, saying they were being harassed by the media. Canadian authorities say they're not ruling out further arrests. Josh Meyer covers security issues for the Los Angeles Times, and he joins us now with the latest. Josh, do you know the latest on the case? Tell us what we've learned.
Well, there were some court documents filed yesterday in preparation for the bail hearings today, and the Canadian authorities laid out some of the charges, especially against the 12 adults, and they alleged that they range from training terrorists themselves to plotting to cause a fatal explosion to conspiracy charges.
Do we know who at least the 12 adult men are?
Well, initially authorities and the Canadians have different rules for discussing things with the press than the United States authorities. They're even more tight-lipped than the feds are here. Initially, they had said that many of these people were South Asian, suggesting Pakistani origin, for instance. But now we're starting to hear that they're from Canadian residents, most of them Canadian citizens, and that they come from backgrounds as disparate as Somalia, Egypt, Jamaica, Trinidad, for instance, and other places.
Josh,
that they grew up in Canada.
Mm-hmm. One thing we're finding interesting is that two of the suspects were already serving a 2-year sentence for bringing guns and ammunition from the U.S.
Right. They had pretty scary weapons strapped to their legs. I think one had it strapped to his or taped to his stomach when they were crossing the border. And I'm fairly positive, although the authorities don't want to confirm such details, that they had been followed and that they were or that the authorities were onto them somehow when they were trying to cross the border with the guns.
I see. And then kept on them, apparently.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, that leads to the other question. What speculation is there that any of the group might have had other ties to other alleged ties to other terror cells, especially here in the U.S., given that these two were caught bringing guns and ammunition from the U.S.? I guess they crossed the Fort Erie Peace Bridge into Canada.
Right. Right. Well, and that's the hard part about trying to track these groups, especially when they're conferring on the Internet or allegedly conspiring on the Internet as well, exactly who is a co-conspirator of whose. They do believe that at least some of these guys had connections to two men who were taken into custody in the Atlanta area in Georgia several months ago, and that the two Atlanta men went up to Canada to conspire with some of these guys, describing them as like-minded militants. They also, we reported the other day, yesterday, that the authorities are investigating ties to other militant groups in at least 7 countries, and that they've made about 18 arrests so far.
By the way, do we know the countries?
Yes. United States, Britain, Bosnia, Denmark, Sweden, Bangladesh are some of them, and Canada, of course.
Right. Is anyone alleged to be emerging as a leader in the group?
Well, the authorities are very hesitant to speculate on that, but there is a guy. Most of these guys are very young, between the ages of, teenagers to 23 years old. But there's one guy who's 43 years old, Qayyum Abdel-Jamal, and And people that are familiar with him say that he filled his sermons at the local mosque with diatribes against the United States, hate-filled, you know, speeches and so on. But again, you know, that's secondhand information. I think the authorities are trying to nail that down. I do know that they have a lot of electronic intercepts of both phone calls and emails, so they appear to be pretty confident that these guys were involved in some sort of terrorist activity and that they might even be, you know, that plotting something that was imminent.
And they're alleged to have been plotting, you know, blowing up Canadian buildings or some sort of plot to blow something up.
Right.
And they're alleged to have tried to procure three times the ammonium nitrate, the fertilizer that was used in the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. How
right.
close did they get to getting that?
Well, again, that's another one of the murky details about this. What is clear is that they ordered 3 tons of ammonium nitrate, which is a fertilizer that, if you mix it with fuel oil, it can form an extremely powerful explosive. And they did take custody of the ammonium nitrate, according to the federal authorities. The question is whether the authorities delivered it to them or whether the feds were just piggybacking on the delivery from a manufacturer and so on. Mm-hmm. But that's an extremely large amount of ammonium nitrate.
By the way, I'll jump in and say that the Toronto Star, which has been doing some terrific reporting on this,
right.
Says that the investigators had the group under surveillance, learned of the alleged purchase, and intervened, and they switched the fertilizer to a more benign substance and then moved in after that bogus substance was delivered.
Right. Yeah. Right. I mean, you know, and what the authorities confirmed to me was that they were watching this group and that every step of the way they were involved in making sure that they didn't get their hands on something that could be used as an explosive. So it's sort of a tacit confirmation that they did, you know, that they did intervene in this case, and the authorities were the ones that delivered what they presented to be ammonium nitrate to these guys, and that they took custody of the fertilizer.
Mm. Well, Josh Meyer, again, of the Los Angeles Times, you are steeped in these security issues. What are U.S. officials saying?
Well, I mean, you know, they're very concerned about this. I've been sort of resisting writing the story about how, you know, this proves that something could happen in the United States, and because it's not a new phenomenon, and unfortunately I've written that story, you know, several times over the past 5 or 6 years. I mean, starting back in 2000, late 2000, early 2001, the Ahmed Rassam case, he was another Canadian of Algerian French origin who was caught at the border trying to bring a carload full of explosives into the United States, allegedly to detonate an explosion at Los Angeles International Airport. So they've been concerned about this for many, many years, not just now, but they do think that there's a lot of homegrown terrorism cells that are conspiring on the Internet, that they're getting sort of radicalized by discussing things on the Internet, going into chat rooms, and that they could be, you know, hidden places where they can't find them, and that suddenly they'll just launch an attack without any warning.
And you talk about the Internet again. These many of the men in the 12 who are accused were alleged to have attended training camps, prayed at the same storefront mosque.
Right.
But what was the role of the Internet?
Well, I mean, you know, the Canadian ambassador to the United States just said yesterday that that it was very significant, and that's what the authorities are saying as well. You know, it's sort of like a virtual reality for these guys, where they, you know, guys from different countries can be talking to each other in real time and discussing, you know, plots and even just political rhetoric. I mean, the hard part is, several authorities told me, is distinguishing between the guys who really are intent on committing acts of terrorism from others who just basically use the Internet to send messages, you know, suggesting that somebody should attack this, or, you know, criticizing the United States and Canada and calling for attacks. So it's hard to decide who are the real, you know, the operational guys from the guys who are just sort of like-minded militants and sympathetic to the cause and so on. But a lot of the radicalism it comes from, you know, watching videotape of carnage in Iraq and so on, and it's a tool that's being used by al-Qaeda and affiliate groups and even just grassroots militants.
And we should point out that you report that officials used electronic surveillance of phone calls as well, another hot-button issue right now.
Right.
Josh Myers, he covers terrorism for the Los Angeles Times. Josh, thanks as always.
You're very welcome, as always.
You're listening to Here and Now. Well, talk about drive time. A company here in Massachusetts is giving new meaning to that phrase. It's paying school districts across the state to air custom-made radio broadcasts complete with ads on school buses.
Bus Radio.
Did you know we're giving away $200 cash on our website? All you have to do is enter the Word of the Week contest at busradio.com. Here's another Bus Radio safety message. Never run after the bus if you've missed it. Go home and find a safe adult to help you get to school.
The company is called Bus Radio. It says it signed up schools representing about 100,000 kids to listen to daily hour-long feeds consisting of 44 minutes of pop music, 6 minutes of safety messages, 2 minutes of corporate-sponsored contests, and 8 minutes of advertising. Critics are howling, is no place safe from advertising for kids? But officials in Woburn, one school district that has tested the service, says it keeps kids in their seats. Well, we turn now to Peter DeRove. He's Assistant Superintendent for Personnel and Finance in Wakefield, Massachusetts. And Peter, you considered Bus Radio. What did you decide?
We did not go forward. We had some concerns about the control issue, and also we could not confirm on the amount of revenue it would generate for us.
Well, let's talk about the control issue first. We understand Bus Radio says that these radio shows will be in part put together by kids who can go online and pick out some music.
That's part of the selling point, but again, when we looked at it and our subcommittee, the budget chairman at the time of my subcommittee, when we were reviewing it, one of the issues, of course, is it is a captured market. And the question becomes, what exactly was going to be done? And that was one of the potential side issues that we were reviewing at the time or trying to contemplate. For us, it was very similar to a program that was a couple of decades ago, I think called Channel One.
This is
TVs were given to school districts, but then again, there would be a certain time they were supposed to be on, and there were certain commercials and so forth. So again, it becomes a question of dealing with the parents and the exposure to the children. The parts that we looked at that were important were they're contending that, of course, would make the bus safer, i.e. the kids would be more calm, less, shall we say, disruptive to the driver, therefore the ride would be safer and it would generate income. Well, we couldn't confirm the income, so that was an issue for us as well.
Well, and you say income. We understand that Bus Radio is paying school districts to carry the equipment and carry the service twice a day, morning and afternoon. You have a relatively small district. Was that one of the considerations, that maybe there just wouldn't be enough money in it for you? And I guess the second question is, if there was enough money, if they could show you that there'd be a lot of revenue for it, would it be too hard to turn it down?
Well, it can be hard to turn it down, especially when we were in fiscal crisis in the last couple of years. But because, again, we're only we have 3,500 students in the district. We bus between 500 and 600. It isn't a lot of exposure.
Well, you know, and you mentioned the other issue, that this is a captive market. These kids have no choice. I mean, who wants to, you know, be in any kind of vehicle and restricted to only one radio, unless, of course, it's public radio? But were you at all concerned about the other thing, which is that these kids would have to listen to commercials? A lot of parents are trying to keep their kids, you know, away from all the attempts to advertise to them.
Well, that's part of it. The other part that we, you know, again, you have to listen when people talk safety. And that was a key component to look at, which was the testimonials that were coming from some of the bus drivers in other communities saying that the kids were paying more attention to the radio, therefore were focusing on that and not necessarily bouncing around in the seats and teasing the kid next door, next to the seat or whatever. And so that is a very, very big concern, obviously, for us. But then again, for some of us, our kids are on the bus for only 15 minutes, so there isn't a lot of time that they'd be sitting and focused.
Right.
If you know what I'm saying,
you didn't feel as if you needed an hour-long babysitter in the form of bus radio on your buses.
Right.
That's Peter DeRove, Assistant Superintendent for Personnel and Finance for Wakefield, Massachusetts Public Schools, on Bus Radio. Here's a little more of what they decided not to put on their school buses.
Don't you want to go for a ride? Just keep your hands.
This is Bus Radio.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now.
New Kelly Clarkson song.
Walk Away?
Yeah, that's it.
I like that one.
I know, me too. My friend hasn't heard it yet, so I really wanted to hear it.
It's on right now.
I'm looking for attention. I don't know the question. Should you stay or should you go?
Bus Radio is on.
peach from a local farm stand, say, as opposed to that cold, hard, tasteless orb you get at most chain stores. Mas Masumoto is a third-generation farmer who grows organic peaches, nectarines, and grapes on his 80-acre farm south of Fresno, California. He's the author of several books on farming, and he was the scholar-in-residence at a recent conference of culinary professionals in Seattle. That's where Here Now's resident chef Kathy Gunst asked him about fruit farming, including, why don't most store-bought peaches taste like peaches?
One of the problems I think that's happened with fruit was at a certain point they decided, they meaning the industry, decided that they wanted to look at it as a commodity, which meant that they're going to grow it a certain way and look for a market and retailers that would market it like a commodity. Some of the issues were involved were shelf life and color. They wanted red, red, red fruit that would connote ripe, whether or not it would be ripe. And the other aspect was they wanted something that would sit on the shelf for weeks without breaking down. So as a result, you ended up having something that looks like a peach, maybe even sits on the shelf like a peach, but doesn't always taste like a peach. Still, there are thousands, millions of boxes of these new peaches, you might say, that are being sold and somebody's buying them. So it's hard for me to say that's wrong. It's clearly different than the type of farming that I do. And if anything, that differentiation helps make the things that I do stand out.
So if I came to your peach farm, can you paint me a picture of what I would see and what I might be able to taste there?
If you came during the summer when it's ripe, the first thing I think you'd notice would be different is that there's lots of green. The ground is covered with either cover crops that I've planted, or there's lots of weeds that I allow to grow. This is an organic farm, and we want that kind of life out in the fields. Then when you look into the canopies of the trees, first of all, my trees tend to be older. And the reason why is I haven't replanted them with the newest variety. And if you look into trees, it's best to come early in the morning because the sunlight at that time of day strikes these peaches. And unlike these spotlight red peaches you'll find in many conventional orchards, you'll find these peaches are glowing with this amber, rich, golden color. To me, that's a real peach.
Can you name some of the names of the trees you have and maybe describe the taste?
Oh, the peach that I love is the Suncrest peach. And it was a peach that actually was very popular throughout the California United States right in the 1950s. And this peach was that older yellow flesh peach that when you bite into it, the nectar just explodes in your mouth. And I've also planted in a crazy way this old heirloom variety called Alberta. And a lot of people will go, peaches, Albertas, and then they'll realize they haven't seen an Alberta in 10 to 20 years. Well, I went out and planted some. One of the greatest fears is that a generation is growing up that has never tasted a wonderful peach. Because if you've never eaten something that's wonderful, how do you know you're missing it? And it strikes terror in my heart. It wakes me up at night in the middle of summer when I have, you know, thousands of peaches on a tree thinking, is someone going to really eat these? Does someone really want them? Because how do they know what they want if they have no memory of it? And that's why through my writing and farming, I'm intrigued by that power of memory. And certainly an older generation, you say Alberta, and they know exactly what that Alberta tastes like. You say it to a young person, and they'll go, what is Alberta? On the other hand, memory is something wonderful because memory can be created. It can be fostered. It can be nurtured. And the other thing I love about memory is it defies marketing. It can't be erased by a 30-second advertisement. So that's why I feel very optimistic.
Well, I can tell that you're a writer because you're very much a poet, and I wanted to ask you about that. How does a peach farmer become a writer, and how do you write about the experience of farming, and why do you write books?
I think there's this rich tradition of storytelling, especially in rural America. It dates back to when farmers didn't have a lot of entertainment, so they told stories. But it also, I think, has to do with how knowledge is passed down from generation to generations. My dad was a very, very quiet man. He wasn't a storyteller per se. But when he did speak, and he usually combined it with actions, he told these wonderful stories. So I think that tradition of passing on knowledge, which you do on a farm, led to my thinking of story and thinking in story. So when I look at the vines, the orchards, and started thinking, okay, how do I learn how to prune a tree? Well, there's the one method where you do it a very mechanical way, where you want to leave so many hangers per branch and all this, or you start looking at it, and my dad would say, you're pruning for sunlight because you want to space the branches out so they have sunlight. And then I would add my story to it, which was I look at a tree and think, you want to shape it so the sunlight could penetrate through the top, and you want to have almost negative space in the middle of winter because you're actually trying to envision summer. And my conclusion was, you prune trees like a wine glass, with these gentle curves. And then it dawned on me, when I looked at trees I didn't prune right, I said, that one looks like a champagne glass. It's just too tight. The sunlight can't penetrate. And then I look at trees that are not doing well, and I realize that's a martini glass tree because the angles are just way too open and they're burning on the sunlight. So I realized that it pays to know your alcoholic beverages when you prune trees. So that's the stories that I do when I farm.
Just to wind up, What will happen with your farm? What do you think will happen with farming? Will we still get to taste these? Will our children's children get to taste these peaches?
One of the challenges, I have two children, a daughter who's 20 and a son who's 14. They both expressed interest in farming. I'm not sure how that will turn out. I doubt if they'll farm the way I am, and that would be fine, because I certainly am farming differently than my dad. The future of small farming, family farming, it's precarious, but the wonderful idea is that farmers can't do this alone. They need others around them, and that's where this whole world of food, people who support everything from farmers markets to organic marketing to consumers who just take interest in knowing how the food is grown and who grows it, that all supports these small farm operations. And that's where I feel wonderfully optimistic, because if you look at the economics of it, it could be dismal. But then you stop and you ask, especially the old timers, why did they do this? You stop and think, especially now that I'm getting older, I'm in my 50s now, I'm beginning to realize you don't do things just for money. You do things that have meaning and have significance. And that's where suddenly this whole new world opens up, and I've become a little more optimistic.
Famed farmer and author Mas Masumoto speaking with Here Now's resident chef Kathy Gunst. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Manigan, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Milena Spitzer, Deborah Becker, Molly Hamill, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Sugards is our engineer. Our web producer is Janie Lorber. Our interns are Lauren Morand, Jessica Wall, and Jamie Ulrich. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Pick the next president.